This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 273 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
And now it's feedback for last week's episode, episode 403, The False Bride. First up, we have Amy D.
Hey, Ginger and Summer, it's Amy D back with you for Outlander season 4. I have some comments on episode 3, The False Bride. I've read some criticism of Claire and the way that she reacted when Jocasta was accusing her of robbing Jamie of what he really wanted, and that Jamie was somehow blinded by his passion for Claire, and that was why he turned down the offer of River Run. Some people have said that Claire was rude, but I didn't see it that way. First of all, Claire was right. Jocasta doesn't really know Jamie, especially Jamie as a man. She's not in any position to make any kind of judgment call about him, about his wife, his marriage, or their decisions. Jocasta is being accusatory, as she's prone to do. And Claire, as we know, always says what she means. Diana has told us many times that Claire has no poker face, so I think it makes sense then rather than hiding what she was feeling, she just said what was on her mind. I didn't find it rude. I found it straightforward and honest, and quite frankly, it was a defense of her marriage that I think she was entitled to. That said, I do rather wish we'd heard the line from the book where Jamie says that he knows what it's like to be owned by another person, and because of that, he can't ever own slaves. I think that would have made Claire's statement to Jocasta even more powerful. Even if Jamie didn't say it to Jocasta, just to know that that was his thought, I think would have really enriched the viewing experience. And John Bell just continues to impress the heck out of me. He goes from boyish and goofy to mature and strong in the blink of an eye, very much the way a young man of his age would. Young Ian is a favorite character of mine in the books, and darned if I don't love him even more since John Bell began bringing him to life. I look forward to all that is to come with this character. The Mustang to wagon transition was fantastic. Seeing Bree and Roger in the Mustang driving down a beautiful mountain highway, segueing directly into Claire and Jamie in a horse-drawn wagon traveling down what was the same path, was really spectacular. The mountain in the distance was the same shape, so I think that that was the intention of the show, was to show us the same location in two different centuries. And after visiting North Carolina and the Blue Ridge Mountains in April, I can say that much of the scenery is very, very much like North Carolina. So much so that I wouldn't be surprised if the show did shoot some exterior shots in North Carolina and use them, even though the show itself films in Scotland. I was really impressed this episode with Sophie Skelton. She's beginning to really embody Brianna. She's got some nice, meaty stuff coming up, and it's good to see her really taking hold of the character now. Richard Rankin is simply amazing as an actor and as a musician. I cannot say how much I adore him. The big scene with Roger and Bree was great. They brought the love and anguish to life so well. I didn't really find Roger hypocritical with his "I thought you were a virgin" comment. I think he's trying to make sure that Bree knows that she's set apart from all of the other women he's ever been involved with. He wants her to know that she is different, that his feelings for her are different, and he wants to do things differently with her, because for her he's willing to wait, because she matters. And the following night, at the calling of the clans, the line that Roger delivers to her, "I'll have you all, or not at all," was perfect. I loved that line in the book, because I think it really speaks to what's in Roger's heart for Brianna. When Bree leaves, as Roger is calling the Mackenzies, his look of longing when he looks back and sees her gone, oh my goodness. I think maybe they're setting up for the final scene of the season, and I cannot wait, because I love the ending of Drums of Autumn. Thanks for the podcast, ladies. Looking forward to next week.
Thanks, Amy. Always love hearing from you guys, and you shared a lot. And I think you hit a lot of the highlights that we talked about last week as well. Next up, Michael M.
Howdy, Ginger. Howdy, Summer. This is Michael from Shawnee, Kansas, with my feedback for Outlander episode 403 and a couple of comments on this podcast. First, I really like this episode. For me, it is probably the best adaptation from book to show yet. My assessment may be biased since I have now read Drums 3 times and it's still fresh in my mind from participating in the read-along. I will even go so far as to say I like young Ian's presenting his case for staying in the colonies more than the Grange-like letter from Jenny telling Jamie there's not much in Scotland for young Ian and to keep him with them. The letter kind of lets young Ian and Jamie off the hook for any consequences that may result from young Ian's decision to stay and Jamie allowing it. The other change I really liked, and this one is only for the sake of the show, is the relocation of the Scottish festival to North Carolina. I thought this was an excellent move about the podcast. I want to say thank you for a return to your instant feedback on the listener feedback. For me, it adds a lot to the podcast, so thank you. I will say that I feel that summer missed an opportunity for a quick quip, unless that is you intentionally held back. When Ginger was providing us with coverage of the music during the scene in Bree's room at the lodge, she mentioned that this was the pinnacle of Roger and Bree's story in this episode. Note, Ginger used a different word than pinnacle.
Definitely Roger and Bree climax of the episode.
Summer, I was expecting you to declare that Roger and Bree did not pinnacle. That's all I have to know. And once again, thank you.
Oh, Michael. Oh, my goodness. Yes, they definitely didn't pinnacle. And they didn't climax, but it was the musical climax. Oh, my goodness. And finally, Susanna M.
Hi, everyone. This is Susanna from Lisbon, Portugal. I wanted to tell you, Ginger, that I really loved your breakdown from the songs. I never listened to the songs, and this last few, I was paying attention, and for the first time, I heard the Jamie and Claire theme song. I really enjoyed it. There's another thing I wanted to tell you, and I've been wanting to say it for a long time, and this episode, Jocasta gave me the opportunity to do it. I really thought that she was a witch, which in Portuguese means bruxa. Now you know how to say it. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Susanna. Yeah, we got, if it wasn't you, it was someone else, but we definitely got the bruxa comment last season. So thank you so much.
And now on to the episode discussion version section of this podcast, when we will be discussing episode 404 entitled Common Ground.
Okay, first up, Robot to Tearprick. I got a 2. What did you get, Sam? Got a 0?
Yeah.
I'm definitely getting used to the music. Meaning the intro. It is growing on me more each week. And this is the first week that the ending of the two ska, whatever, didn't. And yes, I'm over dramatizing that. It was the first week that didn't actually bug me. So that's how I can tell that it's growing on me more. This week, the writer of Common Ground was Joy Blake, and the director was, again, Ben Bolt. The opening title card was, we find out later, they're Cherokee. They were dressing. They were putting on some kind of clothing, maybe ceremonial, maybe not.
But it was just like a lot of accoutrement. Cherokee hair, Cherokee bracelets, Cherokee necklace, Cherokee boot.
And then the cape, or the cape, whatever that was, yeah. We get a lot of and this may not be the right musical term, but this is all I know. So if you guys know better, or if Bear has already said it better than this, please let me know. So we get a lot of what I consider very native sounding instruments or music. So we get some drums, not a ton, but a little bit of drums. We get a Native American flute sound. And also the sounds that are coming are very ominous. They're maybe not scary, but they're like not pretty. They're not happy and peaceful.
It's like the dissonance before the common ground. Ha!
And the episode after the title card, the episode opens in Wilmington. They're in Wilmington in the 18th century. So Jamie is signing a land grant from Governor Tryon, and they confirm it's 10,000 acres. And Governor Tryon also gives Jamie a chart, which is a map of his land.
how else are you going to know how to find the things if he doesn't?
So he also offers to make accommodations for Claire if she is going to stay behind in Wilmington while he settles and clears the land and makes it a little more hospitable for a gentle lady. And Jamie's all, nah, she's good.
He's like, she's not a gentle lady. I will be taking my lady with me.
Tryon warns him about the selection of settlers, and he is talking about some of the trouble. He's like, basically, you know, choose your people, choose wisely, because there's stuff going on and there's troublemakers out there and you don't want any of them. Not only because they cause trouble, but also they can cause you trouble and they can maybe make this whole shakedown thing come sooner than later. He mentions the regulators, so we need to keep that in mind, who have been stirring up trouble in the Piedmont. And the governor says, quote, what is wrong is disorderly conduct and their continued failure to pay their taxes, unquote. And I wrote, just you wait.
But it felt like a whole not only just choose your men wisely, but also it's not only because they might do X, Y, Z, but I can tell you from experience that even on our side, we're not always choosing wisely and we're also having to bear the brunt of it. So it was almost like commiserating, I think.
Because he speaks from experience and he's not trying to be a douche. He's really trying to say, look, I know you have a big responsibility here, but just be very careful because we know shiz is happening and, you know, I would prefer it didn't happen for you as well. And the comment about the taxes made me laugh because, can we say tea party? Okay, so the problem is that the taxes are not reaching the treasurers. Now, I don't know if that means people legit aren't paying them or if they're being paid and the people as they're being taken from the tax collector to the treasury or the treasurer, that someone is like attacking the collector. You know what I mean?
I don't know. I took that to mean that the soldiers that were collecting were not turning over. We're not giving all the money in, which was why his whole pick your people right.
So that might be a reflection of what. Yeah, be careful who you choose. Got it. That makes sense.
And I could be wrong. That was just my interpretation.
Something is basically going on here. He's giving him for good reason. And out of his own experience, a very fair and important warning about, you know, stuff goes down. Choose wisely, number one. Number two, he mentioned specifically the regulators. And so that's something that's from history that just keep in the back of your mind. Those of us who are along with us for the read-along will remember this. And it's just important to keep that name, that noun in your mind, regulators. Okay, the music here is ominous. The governor says, quote, it's said that the Highlander is much in common with the Indian savage, unquote. Again, if I use that word, it will only be in a quote. We've heard this before.
Yeah, we heard it from Ian like 2 weeks ago.
Yes. So not in these exact words. Summer and I have mentioned it. Others have studied and written about this. Agav, our friend, the Gaelic expert, has mentioned this. Jamie's response to this, quote, savagery can exist in many forms, Your Excellency. I've witnessed it in both prince and pauper. And the governor replies, those that live in defiance of his majesty are no better than barbarians. Often the law is inefficient in containing them. So I know they're both speaking, they both have sub-meaning here, but especially from the governor, with that last line, that puts me right back with the last talk about uprising. you know, it's just, they're no better than barbarians. Those who live in defiance of his majesty are no better than barbarians. Well, that was the Scots, right? Or that was the Jacobites. That was those who were the Jacobites and those who supported them. That's how the government saw the Jacobites and their supporters as barbarians. Often the law is inefficient in containing them. Well, they had the legal standing. The king ordered them to be taken care of. So it's not that they were, quote unquote, illegally conquered. Obviously, it was awful what happened to them with Battle of Culloden, and then following that, the clearances. That was not good. But my point here is that is what comes to my mind when the governor says, those that live in defiance of his majesty are no better than barbarians. Often the law is inefficient in containing them. So it just put me straight back to pre-Culloden. And I think it sends Jamie back there. And then this next line is actually Jamie giving the governor back his own words that came from, I think, episode one. And that is, Jamie says, there is the law and there is what is done. So yes, they do have an understanding of each other.
Yeah, there was lots of parroting of lines this episode.
Yes, parroting. There you go.
Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. They achieve this by supporting a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs.
This month, I cannot wait to get Blue Apron's cheesy vegetable calzones with tomato dipping sauce and Caesar salad. Not only is it vegetarian, so there's all kinds of options, y'all. It also is delicious. I have loved every single box I've ever gotten from Blue Apron, every single recipe, which I've chosen.
So I've been enjoying all of the broccoli options because I love broccoli. And I'm getting excited because kale is becoming highlighted again. So I just get excited when the freshest vegetables start coming in that I know I'm going to enjoy.
So how does this work? You choose chef-designed recipes, and Blue Apron delivers fresh, seasonally inspired ingredients, and you will cook incredible meals in as little as 20 minutes.
Blue Apron offers a range of recipes bursting with flavor. Whether you're looking for quick and easy meals or a full culinary cooking experience, Blue Apron lets you choose from a range of recipe options. Get out of your cooking rut and experience the joy of new recipes with chef-designed recipes and restaurant-quality meals.
So check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free at blueapron.com/outlander. That's blueapron.com/outlander to get your first three meals free.
Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
So outdoors, or we go outdoors, we're still in Wilmington, and our leading family is preparing to leave for the backcountry. Claire is buying some supplies and she's talking with Marsley. She says that she just like goes on and on, not badly, just she talks about like how bad her morning sickness is. She talks about how she misses her mom.
She got real pregnant, like real pregnant. And I was concerned that she's still having such severe morning sickness as pregnant as she is. Followed by the fact that then she was like, there's no other healer I'd rather have with me if something goes wrong during the birth. And then follows that later on by saying, we'll send word as soon as the Baron's here. As soon as the Baron's here. So there's no one I'd rather have with me, but you're not going to be there. So I'll let you know when he's here.
She misses her mom and she says that she'll join them all. They will join them all on the ridge once the baby has come, as Summer said. Also, as Summer said, she is huge. No, she's not a huge woman. I'm just saying, compared to what we saw her last, she's huge. So she has to be, even though, remember, their clothing definitely gives them bulk. But I would say at least 6 or maybe 6 months, 7 months.
Yeah. And if nothing else, it backs up the fact that a lot of time has passed. So they're using that as something where you're like, wow, it took them a lot of time to either figure out where they wanted to get their 10,000 acres, get back to town, agree on it, get their stuff packed and get ready to go. So it wasn't like they just went to the ridge, said, I like this, and then got the paper the next day. And then they're like, we live here.
So in episode 401, they state at least one time that it's been 4 months since they crash landed in the colonies. And that is the same episode where Marsley announced, or I guess Fergus did, announced their pregnancy. They're having a baby. So, but that doesn't mean she could have been 3 months along, right?
Mm-hmm.
She could have been, let's say she could have been 3 months along, because she wasn't showing, at least to our eyeballs, not like this week. She wasn't showing at that point, at least to this extent. So if she were, she could have been 4 months pregnant. She could have been pregnant when they left Jamaica. Who knows? But let's say she were 3 to 4. As big as she is, I'm guessing 6 to 7. So it's at least, if she's 3 months pregnant and she's 6 months now, it's been at least 3 months. If she's was three and is now 7, that's been 4 months since episode 1. Otherwise, it's been either 3 or 4 or 5 or 6. So either way, that's a lot of time. There's a lot of time going down in between these.
Or, Cesar, whatever his last name is, I can't pronounce it. Maybe he just makes giant babies.
Maybe.
I don't know. We'll have to, ask him. Do you make giant babies?
Jamie is telling Fergus to be careful in his selection of settlers because he's enlisting Fergus, which makes perfect sense. He's there. He's going to have a lot better, lot easier time finding people than Jaime is, because not only is Jaime and co busy, will they be busy? They're going to be up in the boonies. So there's little to any contact.
But I feel bad because they're really stationed in Wilmington. So he can't go anywhere. So he is placing all of his, hedging all of his bets, I should say, and placing all of his eggs in the basket of, well, here's hoping that all of the Ardsmuir dudes and Scottish people all come and find you in the city of Wilmington. Well, because in the books, and I know that people hate it when you're like, ah, but in the book, Duncan Innes traveled and around, looked, yeah, looked for Ardsmuir people and looked for settlers, whereas Marsley and Fergus are stationed in Wilmington. So it's really them hoping the right people come through the town and they happen to find them. Unless there's some other method that I haven't thought of.
No, I think, I don't think he's going to be traveling like Duncan did, because obviously his wife is about to go, or soon going to go into labor. So I don't think he's leaving. But I think because Wilmington is the capital or one of the largest cities in North Carolina, and that's where a lot of Scots either were sent or traveled to, I don't think he has to travel a lot. He might be able to get more by traveling, but he's in like town central or Scott central. So he needs to go out and, you know, circulate among the peeps and be out there when the boats come, right? Boats come in, but I don't think we're going to lose much. I mean, it is what it is. We have him doing this now, but he's just saying whatever he does do, Jamie's just sharing the governor's message of just be careful in your selection. He tells him find Highlanders. So obviously he wants him to be very selective and very specific. So he's asking for help.
He needed to be even more specific. Find Murta.
I was just about to say, I wonder if he'll bring a, I wonder if he'll bring a Murta with him when he comes up with the baby. It would be a perfect opportunity.
I don't know. We'll see. You know, somebody put a picture online. I don't know if it was real or not, but somebody had a picture of a gray-haired dude from the back walking up the, what is that called? The dock at River Run.
The jetty.
Yeah, whatever it's called. But it was gray haired, longish gray hair from the back walking towards River Run. And people were commenting, ooh, I wonder if it's Murta. I wonder if it's Murta. And it could be. I don't know. But, and then somebody said that he is credited in episode 405.
Well, then. So
we'll see what happens next week, y'all.
Fergus says that they'll write once the Baron arrives, and then I think it's Ian, but someone says they'll have a cabin waiting for them. So that's exciting. I can't wait for Le Bébé and them.
I mean, I hope that Ian understands how hard it is to build a cabin.
Dude, at the end of the episode, it's been however long and they barely have the outline for one.
Right. And there's only really three of them. I mean, John Quincy Myers by the end is all strapped up and healing, yeah, and he's only really staying until he's healed, so he's not any help while he's there, for real.
No,
maybe just like jerking meat, but
didn't know where you're going with that one.
But I know, but it's just Ian and Jaime and, you know, Claire sharpening axes, so I don't know how the three of them are going to make cabins for literally everyone.
So Claire and Jaime chat. Claire's thinking about Bree, and since Mar, something like that person, is just about her age, Bree's age, it's just bringing her daughter's memory to her more. Under this conversation, there is beautiful music, and I think I hear a clarinet, so it may be there. It may not be there.
Is that spelled C-L-A-I-R?
That's funny.
I-N-E-T.
But Claire is lamenting not just with Bree. Obviously she misses Bree, but it hits her like full force, like, holy monkey balls, what did I give up?
Well, because it's not something you think about. I mean, it's not, because that's not a place where Bree was when she left. So that's not the place in her life where Bree was. So that was not anything that was in the forefront, right? So now being,
yes, she's just hitting her now that she won't be there to see her grandchildren. And then just under this, whatever that thing was with the thing with the maybe clarinet, it becomes the love theme.
I'll tell you what, I can't recognize the love theme, but I certainly hang for it. But I certainly recognize the Fraser Ridge theme. And I'll tell you why I hear it when it plays in the show, because no one ever talks when the Fraser Ridge theme plays. It's always over a montage.
You're right. It was at the end. You're right.
So that's the only reason. And that's the other reason that I heard the faith theme originally so clearly was because there were no words.
So when you're distracted, you can't hear it.
When there's like dialogue going on, I'm listening to the dialogue. It's not even distraction. When there's things that I'm supposed to focus on, that's what I'm focusing on.
I agree. The dialogue is the most important thing, or the image. Dialogue and the image is the most important thing. But if you are listening to that, you are not able to focus easily on music, right? You don't hear it.
Correct. Oh, it goes da 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 da.
You do hear it, so that's awesome.
That's okay. The only one.
As they make their way out of Wilmington, I didn't see Rollo, and I was like, okay, I know he's in the later episode. What's going on? And like, oh, when they stop at the ridge and they finally get there, and the camera like is behind the wagon but pointed toward the wagon, you see Rollo's actually sitting in the wagon. So I mean, he's there.
He's smart. I'm not going to walk that hallway. Nobody else walked that hallway except for the horses.
Oh, they stopped at the ridge, and the music as they stand, and I don't know if this is it because I didn't sing it at this point, but this is what I wrote. The music as they stand here at the ridge makes me again wonder if there's a ridge theme. So I think that's what you're saying.
I didn't hear it there, though. I heard it at the end during the building.
At the montage.
The montage at the end. That's the only time I ever hear it is the montage at the end of...
Or they're looking over the painting.
Overlooking the ridge, the painting, which is really funny because they made a mention of...
I know.
It being like a painting, and I legitimately laughed out loud at work when I was watching it on my break.
And I was like, Summer said this!
And I was like, oh my God. I laughed because I was like, oh my God, I've been saying that it's just like a painting. So I thought it was funny. But yeah, I was watching it at work on a break and I said that out loud. And I mean, I didn't say that. I laughed out loud and people like prairie dogged and looked at me and I was like, sorry, guys.
So they are literally staking out their claim. Claire's talking to Jamie about the America the Beautiful, which she only calls it America, but I understand why they didn't use the full title. Maybe it wasn't number one. Maybe it wasn't called it back then. But also for Outlander watchers, that's the title of episode one. So maybe not. But I just wanted to say, Claire, just sing the damn song already. But she recites the first few lines or the first stanza maybe. And in case we wondered if Claire ever considered herself an American, her affirmative, quote, we did. To Jamie's question about Americans taking the melody and making a song out of it for themselves confirms it. So Jamie gets hot when Claire sings all proper like she's in church. That made me laugh.
Wait, hang on a second. In my brain, and this is, I can't move forward until I figure this out. She said it's to the tune of God Save King George, which is My Country Tis of Thee.
Yes.
Not America the Beautiful.
My country tis of thee, da da da, sages queen. That's true. And then what is, oh, beautiful for spacious skies, for amber ways. Is that what she recites?
I don't think so.
What does she recite?
Oh, beautiful for spacious skies is not to the tune of God Save Our Queen.
I know, but what does she say?
Or God Save the Crazy. Hang on.
God Save the Crazy?
No, it's our whatever. Well, it was about King George and one of the Georges was crazy.
I think it's called America and people call it the first line.
America, my country, tis of thee.
But I thought it was funny that so whenever Claire sings all proper like she's in church, it makes Jamie hot. Okay, whatever. Whatever, Jamie, whatever floats your boat.
So like, did you notice Ian like complaining? He's like, we must have already put 100 of these in. And I'm like, dude, it's 10,000 acres.
You're going to probably have 1,000 more.
You're going to have, I know. I'm like, saddle up, boy. You are not near done if you've only put 100 posts.
You're the one who chose to stay. You could have got back to Scotland.
Oh my God, but could you imagine if he had left? How in God's green earth would Jamie and Claire have built anything?
They would have had to hire JQM. Yeah. So young Ian points out the witness trees, if I heard that correctly.
That's what I heard too.
Okay. Which marked the boundary of their land. I think it was to the south. I could be wrong, but it was one of the boundaries to their lands that Governor Tryon had told them about. Jamie marks the tree with, of course, he cuts into it, carves into it, with an FR that marks the entry to their land.
Which also means Frank Randall.
Oh, Lord. I don't even think about that. And then literally, Jamie steps in. Literally.
What kind of do you think that was?
No, hold on. No, young Ian, it's not a raccoon. And Claire says it could be a panther or a bear. Okay, about
my guess.
I thought bear was like balls.
Usually there's a bunch. It's all of what they eat. You can see all the things. Like there's usually berries and stuff in there. To me, I wondered if that was Skiliona poop.
Oh, Summer. You thought it was the human?
I totally thought that was just a big pile of human.
It didn't look like long turds.
Crazy. Ginger, he might have eaten something bad. It's a pile. Not everyone has fully solid poops.
I will trust you and any listener or viewer who wants to go back and check it. I will take your word for it. I don't need to look at that again. Yeah, that's all. Just about this time, Rollo alerts them to visitors. And this is right here where the camera goes from behind Claire's back to the Cherokee. That sound, that really ominous sound, that's more dissonance. And of course, signaling danger or potential danger. And a little bit of drums, not too much, but a little bit of drums.
It wasn't funny. I'm not saying it was funny, but I chuckled a little bit because she's just like, there's something right behind me, right? It's like that, what, do I have something on my face? That look of everyone's looking at her. She's like, what? Did I do something?
Jamie tells them to stay back and he goes forward. The dissonance rises and so do the drums, very briefly. He drops his knife, signaling to the whom we come to find out are Cherokee, signaling that he means no harm.
Yeah. And that's the knife drop from the title sequence.
Yes. And this was the party of Cherokee. This was a watch party, it seems. Not like we get together and watch a TV show, but they're like on a watch, on the watch. So, you know, any native tribes would have heard the white men moving through the hills and valleys and everything miles before they arrive, or at least a while before. Although I think Jamie on his own could go, if not fully unheard or unwitnessed. I think the fact that they've got horses and a clarence, and they're probably talking, and they've got a wagon. Like you can't be stealthy with a wagon and a lot of supplies. Then we are shot to the future, Oxford, 1971. So once again, our two shows and fandoms collide. We cannot get away from Oxford, Summer.
Oy. We cannot.
Roger is daydreaming, or at the very least, not able to concentrate at work. He is thinking, of course, about Bree. And after his office mate leaves, he pulls out the book that Bree bought him. And we find out that she also left a sketch of them with the book. Their theme plays here. And because it's more than just a little description, I kept it for the end. But their theme does start here quite a bit. He reads that Mount Helicon, now known as Grandfather Mountain, where the games they attended were, of course. I love that as he reads the passage, we're shown Jamie et al. Beginning to settle Fraser's Ridge.
I dub Roger the lazy historian.
Oh, because he has to go ask other people?
He legitimately did almost no work. Huh. He was handed everything this episode.
Oh, in the book, you mean?
Everything.
Oh, but the Fiona, uh-huh. the other author.
He did no research. He cracked open a book and, oh, there's a mention. I think I'll call the author and see if she has all the things.
So the book also mentions Fraser's Ridge, young Ian dumping rocks, because we go back and forth for a hot second, is dumping rocks or stones. And when he turns around, he picks up a stone and he finds an arrowhead. Now, this is the only thing I thought of in the episode that was kind of, I don't want to say foreshadowing, but I think the best way to put this little thing is that every single episode, we get something with Ian's fascination with the native population.
Yes, I agree with that. But also, to me, the presence of the arrowhead also, to me, was indicative of the fact that
They're not on their own land.
This isn't theirs.
Agreed. That's a good point. So then we're back with Roger. Roger looks at the author on the back of the book. And that finishes his scene. Back on Fraser's Ridge, Jamie gives Claire a tour of their cabin to be. And the best part of this, when she's talking about things that are going on, she mentions John Quincy Myers, jerked meat. I love it.
Yep.
Ian has tied their meat up, keeping it away from animals. And this is very, like, things haven't changed much, right? So he describes at this moment a shed that he's going to build her for her healing stuff. Now, In the official photos released before season four began, some of the photos we got were of Claire's garden. So we know this is not what he's talking about. Obviously, garden needs light and sunlight that can't be under a roof. But he's talking about a shed. So what I'm wondering is, since right now they are planning the first cabin, not, and this is not a spoiler, it doesn't matter the reason they do it, but they just need something to get them through the winter. Obviously, the first thing they do is do that lean-to, which is like very meager. But he is planning their cabin. Later on, they will do something called the big house.
You're speaking of meager. That is better than anything I could build in the woods ever.
No,
I can barely put a prefabricated tent up.
I'm not saying it's not amazing.
It had a door and walls and a roof. It was better than anything I've seen on Survivor.
Oh, no, me too. I'm just saying it was still a very intricate lean-to compared to, or maybe a very intricate twig house, branch house compared to the cabin. You could see it. The cabin had like 4x4 walls. I mean, it was beautifully built. By the end of the episode, we get like the first 3 feet or 2.5 feet of the cabin from the ground up. But right here, he describes to her the shed he's going to build her. And I was like, the shed? That must be like a temper, like the pre-surgery, right? Because he said it'll hold her herbs for drying and where she can see people to heal them as they get more and more settlers. But he doesn't call it surgery. He calls it a shed, but where she can heal people. So I'm guessing that, and it truly is not a surgery. I'm guessing that the formal surgery actually comes, as is true in the book. It doesn't come till the big house. But I just thought it was interesting that he is, I don't remember a shed for her in the book, but doesn't matter. That's cool. Then young Ian is running in, followed by some more Cherokee. And this is not a welcoming. This is not a welcome party.
The first time I saw this, I didn't know what they threw at them.
I thought it was spears.
Right? I was like, what the? And then I noticed that they were returning. They're like, hey, you dropped these.
Exactly. That's funny. So obviously it's a warning. They've taken up some of their stakes and thrown them down at them. And then they ride off. And here the music again is dissonant.
But did you not get a little bit annoyed?
With what?
With our native friends.
Yeah.
Who clearly,
well, at least one of them does,
at the end of the episode, speak English.
Yeah.
And he was the one speaking Cherokee. So I feel like he knows they don't speak Cherokee. And if he knows how to adequately communicate the needs of the tribe to these people, why would he not have taken the time to speak to them in a way that would accurately convey their needs?
On the one hand, I agree, because it would save a lot. It would have saved a lot of time, saved a lot of worry. On the other hand,
I mean, I get it for plot. It's like anything else. It's like if any of your main characters took 5 seconds to have a conversation, we could have fixed it a lot quicker.
No, not even that. Yeah, I'm saying yes, that. But also, it could have made it quicker, yes. But also, think about these colonists, right? These European colonists coming in to land that, as we know, is not theirs. Mm-hmm. It's a very, I wouldn't say 21st century, although we definitely, a lot of Americans, and I'm very guilty of it too, a lot of Americans have this now. So we can't put 21st century, you know, mores or thoughts onto them. But think of it as someone from an outsider, right, coming into your space and taking it over, maybe not like where your actual house is, but on the land where you are, and they start building things. Yes, of course, being able to communicate is like, you know, save yourself grief, right? But on the one hand, well, on the other hand, though, I kind of respect the fact that they are remaining 100% themselves. I don't think speaking English would have hurt, but
no. But however, think of it this way. I don't speak a lot of languages. I speak German, kind of, and English. If there was Germans that showed up on my front yard and started pitching tents on my lawn, and I walked outside, the first thing I'd say is, hey, get off my lawn. And when they turned to me and started talking to me in German, and I realized, oh, they don't speak English, but I speak German, I would immediately turn around and say the exact same thing in German, because the end goal is that I want these people off my lawn.
Oh, I get it. And that was the first thing I said, that having them speak English would have helped their own cause more and have, you know, it wouldn't have gotten rid of the bear dude, but it would have at least maybe made them more of an alliance. They could have reached peace earlier and then maybe tackled the bear dude together. Who knows? But all I'm saying is it's putting,
and I get it,
not blame, but it's putting a lot of expectation and pressure on, oh, if you're the native person, it's your responsibility to do this.
No. And it's not anybody's responsibility, but I'm saying as someone, I mean, I'm not a homeowner, I rent, but if somebody comes into my space and I want them to leave, I'm going to do whatever it takes to get them to leave. And if that includes saying get off my lawn in another language that I already know, I think it's worth it. And I'm not saying that's like, you know, there was an interview that I saw online earlier this week that was Ellen Pompeo was involved in with Gabrielle Union, Gina Rodriguez, and Emma Roberts. And they were at a photo shoot for a magazine. And the conversation veered into Ellen Pompeo speaking about how it is the responsibility of the oppressor in the situation to take care of the minority. So, and I totally agree, because as she stated very eloquently, that it is incumbent upon the white people who created the problem in the first place to fix it and to advocate for the people who aren't being cared for. So, which I totally agree with. So, I think, and I don't know how that totally relates to the situation, but you know how you're saying it's not their responsibility, and it's not to that degree. But so, I mean, I can see it on both ways, because Jamie's like, well, this land is ours, but it's not. And that's like me showing up and going to my neighbor's house and me saying, oh, I rented your property to these other people, so you need to go.
Well, and it's almost the funny thing. It's not funny, but the truth is, Jamie Fraser is fictional, but if the character, or I'll just keep the character of Jamie Fraser, if it came down, because he said, right, he's like, here, I have this land. He didn't say how he got it, but he said, I have this land. We marked it off, but we want to live peacefully, right? He did say that, but he never once, and they didn't, to be fair, they did not push him on it, and it did not come up. But if they had pushed, or had not doubted, but whatever, if they had somehow come up against his right to that land granted to him by Governor Tryon, there would have been trouble, because the character of Jamie Fraser, as much as we love him, is still a man of his time. And as I said, I quoted Diana, I think it's from book four, that something that sets us straight. He is, yes, we love him. He's not a feminist. You know, we can't pull him forward to the 21st century by that. And so what I'm trying to say, the reason I'm mentioning all of this is that Jamie Fraser, the character, would do all he could to avoid bloodshed. Absolutely. I believe he would want to leave peacefully. But if he is, it's really hard to say because you love these characters. He is a European colonist and he is benefiting from the colonization that the British did, that the crown did. Yes, he's having to look kind of like, you know, lie with the devil, because he has to promise that he'll serve and muster up troops if and when this conflict comes, which we know it comes. I mean, the war, obviously, we are now America. We got independence from Great Britain. So I know we're taking this further than the episode went. I'm not trying to add to it. And I'm not trying to, you know, put Jamie in any bad light. But Jamie is a man of his time. And Jamie had no trouble. Yes, he didn't want to own slaves. So he, you know, that's actually an interesting way to approach it, or an interesting way to look at it. Claire and Jamie, but let's be honest, mostly Claire. If Claire could have lived with it, Jamie would have stayed at River Run. Let's be honest. He didn't like it. He would have treated them as nicely as he could.
Well, show Jamie did put that to her.
I know that. But in the book, it was her also. Who was strongly against it. So what I'm saying is that could have...
No. What I'm saying is show Jamie said to her, we could make a difference.
Correct.
If we stay. We could stay. And we could we could work for, you know, work it on the inside.
So once it was clear to them, however it came about, once it was clear that they could not stay, they had two options. I mean, I guess they had more than two, but the biggest options were go back to Scotland or take the governor up for on his offer. So they decided to take his governor up on his offer. What's funny is not Jamie, it's Claire. Yes, early in episode one, 401, when they talk about the land and talk about a little bit of the future and talk about the coming war, she mentions how, not in detail, but she mentions how badly the native population is treated as far as they're moved, they're slaughtered. You know, she mentions it only briefly in passing. And so here we are, episode four. So it's clear to us, and I think everyone can agree, slavery is awful. They couldn't stay with it. They couldn't live with it. However, they came to that decision, they could not stay at River Run, so they took the governor up on his offer. Makes sense. I mean, I understand that. But what surprises me is not Jamie, because Jamie's a man of his time. Jamie's a man of his time. What surprises me is Claire. Number one, being from the 20th century. Number two, knowing the history. Number three, having told him to his face ish what happens to the native population, and now she is part and parcel going with him to be a settler. So I'm not blaming them. Obviously it happened. We're here now 240 plus years later. We all benefited from that. Those of us who are descendants of those early settlers have benefited from the European, mostly European, colonization of a land that wasn't up for sale.
I wonder if they hadn't placed all 10,000 of their posts around their 10,000 acres, I wonder if they just started building the house in the spot they wanted to build it, if they would have even gotten noticed. If they just started building a house in the same spot without trying to put landmarkers like, this is all mine. If they'd just been like, we're just going to pitch our tent here. I wonder if they would have gotten the notice that they got from the local natives that they did when they started placing. Because, I mean, that's a very large space. Yeah. I hang out very often on an 8-acre plot of land. And it's big, y'all. 10,000 acres sounds big. It's bigger than you think. It's huge. So, I mean, if somebody just showed up, some new dude showed up in your neighborhood and just said, these four city blocks are mine. And I'm pretty sure it's even more than that. But that's my point. Like, it's some gargantuanly stupid amount of property in the middle of your area. And they just decided to run a line of fencing or posts right in the middle of your backyard because somebody else told them they could. I mean, I could imagine that would be really perturbing. So I wonder, and we'll never know, but I wonder if they just literally just showed up at the one spot they wanted to build the house and pitched it up, if they would have gotten as much notice.
That's a good wonder. We are once again shoved forward to the future. Oxford, again, 1971. Roger, as Summer already told us, the lazy historian, has written to the author and she has sent him some info. Now, did you do like I did and do a freeze frame and read that letter?
No, of course not. But I did think back to the time that we talked about it. And I don't know if we talked about it on one of our live videos or if we talked about it on an episode about how this made it easier for them to not have to go to Lallybroch.
Oh.
Because they now know when, they now know where, they now know why. So they don't need to go to Lallybroch to look for them.
And I wonder how much of that was planned in to save time or if it was partially because they couldn't get Laura Donnelly. Yeah.
I think it's probably a combination of the above, but imagine what they've done already to progress us as far as they have in the last four episodes. They only have nine more.
Oh gosh. I know.
There's a lot. There is a lot that has to happen in nine episodes. I think that doing away with the Lallybroch side vein that does nothing but gets her to a dock in the long run is something that I'm okay with losing.
Yeah, but she still has to. Well, she doesn't have to. We already know she went to Scotland because that's what Gail tells her. Yeah. So, of course, as I asked, Summer said, no, I did. And here you go. And you're welcome. The letter reads, Dear Dr. Wakefield. Wayfield? Dear Dr. Wakefield, it was a pleasure to talk with you on the telephone. Thank you for your interest in my work. I am glad to hear you enjoyed reading my book. As discussed, please find enclosed a photograph of the deed for the land that became known as Fraser's Ridge, as well as a photograph of a 19th century map which was reproduced of the area. I am also sending you some Xerox copies of other documents relating to Fraser's Ridge that you may find interesting. I had a copy of an archaeological survey of the land available to me, which is believed to identify the location where the settlers first began construction of their buildings. I have included this for your reference. I hope you find this information useful. Please do not hesitate to contact me once again if I can be of any further assistance in your research. Sincerely yours, Karen Bailey, PhD.
Who do you think wrote the letter?
That letter?
To Scotland. The letter to Scotland.
Oh!
Remember she included a letter? Do you think it was Marsley writing to her mom?
It said someone in England.
Oh, I thought, okay. I was like, ooh, maybe it was a letter from
Marsley. That's what I thought. Yeah, no. So now Roger knows that Jamie made it to the colonies. He has a copy of the land grant and a map and a letter. The letter was dated January 1769. So, of course, he calls Brianna in the U.S., in America. He tells her what he found, that Claire had found Jamie and they'd gone to North Carolina. Fraser's Ridge, they found, was not far from Grandfather Mountain. The land grant was 10,000 acres and a letter to a woman in England, which mentions a Jamie Fraser and his wife, Claire, a healer. This right here, I wrote, dude, major tear prick. And she says, quote, I cannot tell you what this means to me, unquote.
But did you not get super excited when Gail showed up?
I did.
I was like, Gail! I literally wrote that. I was like, Gail!
And she had two scenes. That was pretty
she
good.
Did.
So then he makes an excuse. He's like, yeah, I got to go look at papers or something. And she's like, sure thing. Just as they hung up.
It was the most awkward ending of a conversation. So he's like, I have all this news and here's all this cool stuff. Hey, thanks. That's so awesome. You did that for me. Yeah, I've got essays to mark. So I'm going to go.
And then back on Fraser's Ridge. They're sleeping rough while they build their first cabin. I think this is before their lean-to, right? They're still outside?
This has to be the lean-to.
Okay. So Claire thought the skull dude at first had reunited them, but she's like, what if it was a warning? Because he was a traveler like me. And as soon as she mentions TT, the TT theme starts. I'm sorry. Dance of the Druids is too long, but it's the Dance of the Druids theme. Jamie says, no, we were meant to be here. The mountain spoke to me. Really, Jamie?
I don't remember that.
Me either. The line or the mountain speaking to
him? The mountain speaking to him.
Me either. I was like, oh, no, he said it. The problem is I cannot speak with this tribe. This is what he says. I cannot speak with this tribe, with these natives, to tell them that I mean to honor the boundary lines. Claire suggests a gesture of goodwill. And so the next morning, Jamie is off to speak with John Quincy Myers.
Yeah, he's our new Grange.
Later. How far was he? Was he like... He was hanging, but he just wasn't with them.
He couldn't have been that far. He's like, I need my own space.
Apparently.
To jerk meat.
Oh, Lord. Oh, gosh.
Literally. Yeah, I don't know.
Later that night, there's trouble. Rollo is gone. They hear him barking. Jamie thinks it might be the Cherokee. They grab, or the native. I don't think he quite knows yet who they are. They grab guns to go out and see what's up again. The ominous sounding music, the dissonance, and they find that their meat is gone.
That should have been their first clue that this was not some dude. That was not a bear, excuse me.
Yeah. Oh, that's true. That's true. And one of their horses returns injured. His name is Finley. What a cute name. It's got legit bear claw marks on it. And I found it so adorable. Like, that horse is trained, y'all. It was limping back. Did you see it? I was like, that's the cutest thing ever. Oh, we need Linnea on.
Yeah, because she was like, the minute they saw the janky horse, they're like, oh, it was a bear. And I'm like, y'all, think back to the meat that was hanging in the tree. Bears don't know how to do that. They don't know how to cut. They don't know how physics works. They don't know that there's a pulley system that if I cut this rope, the meat will fall. I mean, that should have been their first clue that while there may be a bear type person in the area, that was not who stole their meat. It was definitely at least a group effort.
The next day, Jamie is, of course, with John Quincy Myers, and he says that they talk about the whole bear thing and what's been going on. And he says that the Cherokee have been visited by a Skeela Yona. A Yona, it means bear. He's not sure what Skeela means, but he says it's definitely something that he thinks it's something around something like or akin to evil spirit in the form of a bear.
Now, all together, I would like to point out, and this has nothing to do with whatever you're talking about right now, that John Quincy Myers' outfit is very similar to the Cherokee Native garb that we were building when I worked at Unto These Hills for the 2 summers I worked there on the reservation in Cherokee, North Carolina. So, and that story of Unto These Hills is the story of the Trail of Tears. So it's kind of like the main story is the Trail of Tears. But to tell the Trail of Tears story, they also do kind of like it's in the beginning kind of thing where they show the Spanish soldiers coming and that happening. And so they're integrating. And then you have your main group of characters that are based on historical figures that will figure into the Trail of Tears that makes you care about it. So these are the people that you're following. But in the time of the Trail of Tears, the garb that John Quincy Myers is wearing is a lot like the costumes we were building for that era.
For the Europeans or for the Cherokee?
For the Cherokee.
Oh, the Cherokee wore what John Quincy Myers was wearing?
Yes, they wore very similar outfits.
Okay.
Like
that's cool.
The jacket he wore was very reminiscent. So they did a really good job, the costumers, of having John Quincy Myers be a man of both worlds.
Mm.
So he was still very, I mean, he's very Anglo. He's very white colonialist.
Yes. Do you recognize his accent? It's not English and it's not Scottish.
Is it Welsh?
Yes. I love Welsh. Oh, it's so musical. Sometimes I think Welsh is the most musical, more musical than Scottish.
Could be. It's all the L's, I'm sure. So, but they did a good job of kind of interweaving his character and his costuming for that character to be a man of all sides. You know what I mean? He's kind of, he is the bridge, if you will, between the natives and the colonists.
So as he's there, he mentions like the bear like took our meat. We have this, da da da. And John Quincy Myers offers Jamie some meat and also offers to give him some of the tobacco he got from Jocasta to the Cherokee as a goodwill offering. Now, he says, also, the bear may have been a stroke of fortune. Don't finish building your cabin or the next part of your building process until this whole bear thing is dealt with. So that's what he's trying to say. Like, this is good so that once it allows us to stop what you're doing, take care of the bear so that you're not continuing to have all these things. As long as they're in between statuses, does that make sense? They're vulnerable. Obviously, they'd be less vulnerable if they had their cabin already built, but it's not. And I just think it was very interesting for John Quincy Myers to say that, or it just could be so we got it done this episode, I guess. The Cherokee, he says, the Cherokee have given you a warning, and next time they might not be so nice. One thing I loved in this episode, which they did not have to keep, but the way they wove it in was just so perfect, so perfect. So they have no meat, right? Even if their meat hadn't been stolen, they may not have done this, but it's always a good idea to always look for more food.
Correct. But they did have what was in the bag was non-perishable or more like the salt pork and the cheese and those kind of things. The things that last, that didn't need the refrigeration. Those were the things that she took with her. Now they have to go fresh.
And Ian and Claire have this as he's working on a net. Ian and Claire have their click it conversation.
Oh my God. I literally wrote click it. Click it. Like at least 4 exclamation points.
Okay. Oh. 1, 2, 3. Click it. Claire practices shooting just as Jamie arrives and then he shoots. Later that night or some night, because this could have been 3 nights later, we see a group of Cherokee walking through the woods carrying torches.
As someone who currently weekends at a house in the mountains that has no central heating and air, that seemed like a really big waste of wood to use it for target practice. I was like, oh, she's going to be so cold.
Oh, just to shoot it? Yeah. I was a little surprised. So they're walking through the forest, I think in the dark or at twilight, but they have torches. And we find out in the end, they're not going towards the ridge. They're going toward their village or a village. So something that seems to be a bear also was kind of on. They go back and forth between the Cherokee in a line with the torches marching somewhere and then back to the ridge where Jamie and Claire and Ian are to they hear more noise, and there's a big black or dark shadowy thing, which we all think is a bear. So Jamie and Ian get up. It's like, I guess they're asleep or they're lying down. Rollo freaks out. Jamie and Ian get up with their guns. Claire grabs one too. Total dissonance means beware. Rollo is whining, and they find a body. John Quincy Myers has been mauled. They get him back to their lean-to, so there's still no cabin, so Claire can doctor him. And Ian stays, he doesn't want to, but Ian stays with her, and Jamie goes out by himself with a gun and a torch. Now, I have to say, before we go on, that this, it's not a ball, but it's a John Quincy Myers surgery. He got his surgery.
But he got his surgery!
Okay, so the group of Cherokee are walking toward a village. I mean, maybe it's their own village and they were out and they're coming back. I don't know, but they're walking toward a village.
You know, to me, it didn't look, I guess I didn't notice them walking. It seemed like a lot of it took place in some sort of common house, like a large gathering.
Oh, no, that's once they get there. Once they get there, they're going through the woods. It's a whole line of them with torches. They arrive at a hut and then they go inside the hut.
Because a lot, okay, I was paying attention to other things, but to me, what I remembered was mostly during the whole bear thing was that they were around a fire the whole time.
Yes, that's once they get there. So one of them, one of the ones who are in this line, enters a hut where it appears a medicine woman is doing a rite. Now, yes, there are men involved, but it seems the one we see later on, it's not Nyowene. It's the character of who is replaced Nyowene, or the same character, a Cherokee name at least. She's there. We see her later. But
they name her Adawehi?
Something like that. Yeah, I have it all phonetics written out later on. Okay, so there's some kind of ritual. Now, I got to say this, and I don't think I'll offend anyone by saying this.
I'm offended.
I think people would probably, definitely, you'll probably agree with me. Okay. So I don't know who it is. We won't know. I mean, I guess we could have watched the credits more closely. But I don't know for sure who the female singer was. All I know is I hope it wasn't Rhea.
Oh, I don't think it was.
That's all I'm saying. If it was her doing a Cherokee or a Native American.
Well, at this point, I'm hoping it would have been Cherokee because them to be so heavily focused on Cherokee this season, it would have been out of place.
To have Rhea.
To have them.
I know.
Yeah.
I agree. I'm just saying, when I heard it, I was like, oh, gosh, please don't let that be Rhea.
So did you notice that when they find John Quincy Myers?
Yes.
And they're like, and they see all the scratches and whatnot. And he says, Skiliona.
Yeah.
He had to know that was not a bear.
I agree.
He should have not said Skiliona. He should have said, dude dressed like a bear.
Mind, knocked out mind, in pain-filled mind. If he, in his pain-filled mind, can go to his second or third or fourth or 20th language, he can go to, it's a man. I mean, you know what I'm saying?
Just like a bear. And had a bear bitten him on the throat, dude would have been
dead.
Well,
he didn't get bit on the throat. He was bitten like on the upper boob, on the upper chest.
That I thought that was his throat. Like the crux of his like throat near his shoulder. That's what it looked like to me.
Maybe near his shoulder, but maybe his shoulder. I didn't think it was at his throat. I didn't think it was that close to his neck. So he finds the bear, or what appears to be a bear. And this is Jamie, and he shoots. The Cherokee at this very moment are taking part, as I said, in this ritual, and there is dancing, and some men are dancing around a fire, and they're holding their fingers out like claws. And then Claire sees that John Quincy Myers was bitten by a
Which to me man. Seemed like deliberate misdirection to give the impression that the Cherokee were summoning the creepy bear dude. Or the Skiliona.
Yeah, I don't understand quite what they were doing.
Well, that's the thing. Because we don't understand their culture and we don't understand what they were saying, all we have to go by is what we see and how we interpret it. And because we are not good interpreters of foreign culture, it felt to me like a deliberate misdirection to make us think that the indigenous people had sent this person to
to kill him or scare them off. And because we knew that the last thing we knew was that John Quincy Myers was being sent to the tribe to be like, hey, have some tobacco. Super sorry about what's going on. This dude's cool. He's cool. He's good people. Let's just all get along. That was the last thing we knew that he was doing. So for him to then show back up at their house, gored, and saying Skeely Yona, and then showing the tribes members dancing around the fire, making bear-like gestures, it was a deliberate misdirection. To me, that's how it felt like. Because I was like, are they trying to tell us that they sent this dude to go terrorize them or scare them off the property?
Well, Jamie is attacked by this man bear, and they fight, and then, of course, Jamie kills him. He takes the body to the Cherokee
village. He was pitched.
And
he was pissed dragging that body. Yeah, he was like, take your bear, man. I brought him back to you.
And he...
Oh, but before that. When he was in the forest and he's tracking bear man and he's got his torch and then he just lays the torch down on the forest floor.
Oh, I saw that. I'm like, how is it not a forest fire?
It must have been very damp. He must have picked moss or something that is not flammable. But that made my heart race in uncomfortable ways. Just because of all the forest fires we've been having in California over the last couple of weeks, I'm just like, oh, my God. I would never, ever, ever, ever in a million years think that the appropriate thing to do is lay my torch down on its side in the middle of the forest. I mean, if he, like, stabbed it into the ground upright – maybe, but like laying it down sideways. Now, granted, he probably laid it down in some like moist moss, something that was not flammable. But that I was legitimately like, dude, he's going to burn his house down before he ever has a chance to build it.
So he arrives.
And how did he find them?
That I don't know. But I got confused, not even about that. So as soon as the bear man dies or he kills him, he makes this, what do you call that thing that he drug him on? A litter. So he builds a litter or a partial litter and brings the man bear to the Cherokee village. So that is clear. But what startled me, and I was like, wait, I thought that happened at the same time. Because after that scene, once he meets them, the next scene, they're back with John Quincy Myers. So I was like, dang, that happened so fast. So right after guy dies, it's at night. He walks him to the village and then they have... He's like, this is the dude. And then they tell him that at this moment, this is when we find out one of the Cherokee can speak English. And Jamie confirms that, yes, it was him that killed the bear man. And they tell him that they once knew this man. He was a great warrior, but he raped his woman. He took her without her consent, basically, and they banished him. The guy tried to return again and again, and then he went bonkers in the woods. He, you know, lived out there. He lost his mind, basically, and that was the man that Jamie had killed.
And I feel like this is not the conversation Jamie anticipated.
Oh gosh, no.
Like, he was dragging that dude back, like, you sent this dude after me, you hurt my friend, you know, we are just trying to be, you know, live in peace and blah blah blah, blah. But he went in there real aggro. So I feel like the minute after the guy was like, you killed this man? And he was like, yeah, I killed this man. Of course I did. You know, all these things happened. And then they were like, he used to be one of us. And then all these things happened. And then Jamie's like, oh, this is not the conversation I anticipated having. After he gets over the shock of, oh, you do speak English. Yeah. Okay, then. And then, you know, eloquently he speaks English. He speaks very good English. Amazing English.
Like a Canadian.
Stop it.
So he says... That he wants to live in peace with them, and he gives them his word.
Quick question. So you know in the Clickett scene earlier?
Yeah.
And she's cleaning the fish out? So there was a part of me. So, okay. Here's my four. I know you. I told you don't do it, and I whatever earlier, but it wasn't foreshadowing, really. But when they first mentioned the bear, I was like, ooh, are we getting the bear scene? And then they show her cleaning out the fish, and I was like, are we getting the bear scene? And then he... has the bear scene, but it's not the bear scene. And then we get back to we came all the way kind of like full circle back to the book where he's still called Bear Killer, but not because she killed a bear with the fish.
Well, she never killed a bear with the fish.
Or she attacked a bear with the fish. Head, but yeah. Like I said, she did hit him in the face with the fish. But since she was cutting the fish, I was like, are we getting the bear scene? So yeah, it was a lot of, again, misdirection by the writers for me, misdirection for Summer of where they were going to go. which is honestly the exciting part of adaptation.
Yep, especially if you know the book. So he then returns, or we then, or well, it is he. Jamie, after his late night event and meeting, returns to the ridge, or at least their clearing, their place. And the next scene is John Quincy Myers is there and he is healing. So this can't be the next morning.
No, I mean, it could have been a couple days later. I mean.
So, but then however long this is, then the Cherokee come again. And this time.
Come again.
To tell them. Huh?
I said come again.
Summer, stop. This time they come to tell him that they want peace also. And the English speaker introduces their chief, Nehuahale, if I read that correctly. And Nehuahale doesn't want any more blood spilled between them. Bear Killer, that is the Cherokee name that he has been given. And young Ian is right impressed. He was like,
Bear Killer. Oh, man, he gets all the cool things.
He's like that little kid. I know, right? Again, more wink, wink, nod, nod to Ian's fascination with the native population. Just like it's over the top now.
Because he's like, what would my name be? Give me an awesome name.
Exactly. Jamie and his family and his friends invite the Cherokee to join them for a meal or for to be right there with them. A woman, Gidua, I believe that's correct, introduces her husband's grandmother, Adawehi. So Adawehi is our Nyawene. If you have read the books, the character, and these are Tuscaroans in the books, but these are Cherokee in the adaptation. So,
and I imagine that the reason that they shifted the names is because those are not
Cherokee names. She tells Claire, this is the one who's doing the interpretation. She tells Claire that Adawehi had a dream about her. The moon was in the water and Claire became a white raven. Flew over the water and swallowed the moon. The raven then laid an egg, and the egg split open to reveal a shining stone. This woman, who is being interpreted, is also a healer. And she says, Claire has medicine now, but she will have more when her hair is all white. She will have wisdom beyond time. That, ha ha, got it.
I know, right?
So then, last part. Then okay. The warning. Quote. Oh, okay. Hold on. It is a warning. Don't get me wrong. It is. It's kind of a warning not to be careful.
Yeah, it's a prediction.
It's a prediction, but it's a warning not about safety or not to do something. It's basically something's going to happen. We're not going to tell you what. Something's going to happen. It's not your fault. That kind of thing. It's kind of like a precognition apology. A precognition. Don't feel bad. It's not, you're kind of like a...
Right. Letting her off the hook.
Yes. And so what she says is, quote, you must not be troubled. Death is sent from the gods. It will not be your fault, unquote. They give us nothing further. But then Claire invites them to come with them and join them.
Now, this was not 100 from the book.
No, but quite close.
Soup's close, right?
Yeah.
So I believe that in the book it was, you will come into your power when all of your hair is gray.
Mm-hmm.
And... sickness is sent by the gods.
Mm-hmm.
It will not be your fault. But like really good. Like I was super excited. Chill bumps.
It was crazy nice.
Chill bumps. And Claire's like, what? I don't understand. And they're like, it's cool. You will. It's the beauty of prophecy. Prophecy you don't understand until you have hindsight.
Yeah. And this is where Summer says, chill bumps. And I say, tear prick. This, because we know what's coming. It's then we're shot forward again to Inverness this time, 1971.
To the lazy historian.
Oh, Lord. Roger is getting his last boxes from the manse. Surprise! And yes, I'm going super fast, I know. Surprise! Fiona knows all about the time travel.
Seriously. After
I thought that was so
but
bad.
She's like, right? But she's like, first, before I get into that, do you like my curtains?
Oh, that's
and Roger's like, I don't care about your curtains. Do they match the drapes? Yeah, so let's not get to the point at hand. Before we get to the important things, I want to know if you like what I've done with the place. And then, yeah, she knows the time travel. And then, like I said, she did all his work for him. So she uncovers all of the historical data that he's supposed to look up. So I find him a lazy historian. Are you still there?
Yeah.
Okay. You're very quiet. You're never quiet that long.
So Fiona knows all about the time travel. And I thought that was shocking, don't get me wrong, but awesome because it just cuts out like all the middlemen.
Right.
Because really fast. And Richard's, the actor, that not Roger, Richard's reaction as Roger was brilliant. He's like, the wah, the what? Like, I don't know what, the what? I don't know what you're talking about.
I'm going to make sure that you know what you're talking about before I admit that I know what you're talking about.
Yes. And so she briefly explains how she knows. She's like, look, my grandma's a caller. She's like, yes, number one, I heard you talk about it through the walls. But she's like, I know all about it. I know all about people and all of these disappearances. He confirms that he hasn't heard from Brianna in quite a while. Since they spoke. And Fiona also magically has documentation. She says her gran used to help the Reverend with his research. And she's recently come across a document, an obituary. And it is from the book. It says on the picture that they showed us. I did not freeze frame it and copy it down because they read it. But it does say the Wilmington Gazette, I think? Am I making that up?
It's a newspaper clipping. I don't know.
I think it's the Wilmington Gazette. But anyway, it's some kind of gazette. I remember that word. But not even an article. It's like a blurb in the section. In the books, it's the same thing. But I always have referenced it as an article. But anyway, it's a blurb in the obituary section announcing the death of Jamie and Claire by fire on Fraser's Ridge. And it is dated. And I think that's funny because in the book it's dated.
It's dated because to give them the exact location of where they are and when they are and when they get there, they had to still give them the nebulous nature of, we don't know when it happens. It's urgent. We have to go now.
Well, in the book she went also because she was afraid.
In the book she went, but she didn't know where they were. So she didn't know how long it was going to take them to find them.
That's right. That's right. Okay. So now, got it. Okay. So in the book, I don't remember the year.
But his math skills were on point because it hurt my brain when he was like, he said, 1770 something. And then he was like, so sometime in the 12 years since they got the property. And I was like, oh my God, my brain.
68. Yeah. So it's 68 is when he says when they went.
And it said 70 blank. So it could have been up to and including 79.
79.
But he came up with that figure so fast that my brain was like, ow, 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 math.
But most importantly from this scene, as in line with the books, I mean, thank God, he decides not to tell her.
Here's my question. Did Fiona tell her because he didn't? Because there's no telling of how long it took for him to go back to his Oxford office and when he called Brie, because he either felt guilt about it or he was calling her for some other reason. But I wonder if Fiona was like, dude, you can't hold that to her, and herself told her, or if Brie is in fact a better historian than Roger and found it herself.
I don't know. I don't know. In the book, she finds it herself, but it's, I know we're not the books. Okay, so we go forward to the Ridge, 1771. They're making their home. This is happy music.
To the tune
music,
of Fraser's
Ridge
theme.
This is the montage. Da, 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 right? Yes. And there's a beat to it, and that's what that kind of made me laugh. He carries her over the threshold of their first cabin, and the Ridge theme continues to play. He describes the layout, and I recognize only when they back up, the camera goes to a wider shot, that she's in trousers. And after she says, it's perfect, the music sweeps up again. And also, I listened to it because twice. I've heard it the first time through, and I was like, oh, wait, huh, what, huh? And then the second time, I didn't remember it, but when I heard it again, I was like, oi, there's a little, I don't know if it's the fiddle or what, but one of the main instruments goes flat. I was like, oh, what?
It's because she's
what?
Wearing pants.
Maybe it was sharp, but I think it was flat. Oh, summer. And then back in Inverness, 1971, again, as Summer said, we don't know how long this is between. Number one, we don't know how long it's been between him calling her about the book or the information from the book or the author. Number one. Number two, we don't know how long it's been since he was in Inverness with Fiona.
But we do know that she has a 2-week head start.
Correct. That's true. So it's been at least, well, that's true, because that doesn't answer the question. That's true. We don't know if she found it before Fiona found it.
Right.
Or we don't know if she found
it. Because Fiona told her.
Because Fiona told her. So it's up in the air. So Roger calls Brie in America. Gail answers. Dang, that actress got two good scenes. Brie's gone to Scotland. She says, Bree's not here. She's gone to Scotland to visit her mother. And she had left a few weeks before that call. And he's like, oh, he knows exactly what this means. Mm-hmm. He's like, oh, F-bomb. And right when this happens, the music is ominous and the episode ends on the Druid theme. But if you continue to watch the closing credits, the outro music turns into the Roger and Bree theme from minor to major.
I haven't seen the preview yet when we recorded this, but I bet my feeling is that next week is going to be backwards 2 weeks.
Oh.
At least in the future portion, backwards 2 weeks with Bree's preparation and then forward to the travel. And then possibly, because I know there is, the Duncan is credited in next week, there will be backwards stuff as well. So, and it won't just be fully focused on Bree. There will be some 1700s stuff as well. So, but I feel like the forward, the 1970s portion of the book, what book, the series is going to be back 2 weeks from where it ended this week.
The 20th century part?
Okay. Yes.
So this, and it's really a lot shorter than last time, Summer and I talked a lot, well, a little bit offline. And what we decided is that if it's something like I've done thus far in the episode saying, oh, right here, there's some dissonance, or, oh, I hear this theme, or, oh, I hear whatever, or if it's a new theme that we haven't talked about or haven't really been able to pin down, and like we did in this episode, we kind of, each of us hummed it once or twice. That is quick, and that does not stop the conversation, right, Sam? It's just like, oh, and by the way, I heard this. Now, if it is like the Roger and Bree scene from episode 403, where it was like almost line by line, I heard something and it was new and it was all over and it was where it landed and what he used and where he didn't finish and all that. If it's anything like that, where it's like I break it down or I do my best to break it down, but it's like much more detail and it's like 5 minutes, not even that, like even 3 to 5 minutes, but it's like my own conversation, right?
It's conversation halting.
Well, if it's my own conversation. If it is just me kind of saying, okay, this is what I heard, but it's not just like, oh, and when he said this, I heard that theme. You know, no. If it's literally I'm breaking something down in a little more detail, I will hold it until the end because that way we can finish our conversation of the episode. Only thing that I really, that is going in this is that in the scene at Oxford where Roger, in the very beginning, when Roger is looking at the book Bree gave him, we hear their theme in its entirety. Only once. But as the scene ends, we hear the first three notes of the theme before returning finally to Fraser's Ridge. These are the two notes, I guess the voice memos that I took. And this is the Roger and Bree theme in its entirety. So last week I said it's something like okay. And then the Ridge theme, which I had already recorded before Summer and I actually talked about it, is this. Okay, so that's basically what we've hummed. So we've isolated them. And so hopefully now with me, like, hello, it only took me four seasons, to pull out the voice memo and pause the recording of the show or go back, hear it a few times to make sure I got the thing in my head, and then record myself singing it so that I can actually then later, if it comes up again, I don't have to go back to like 4 minutes and 32 seconds. So I can say, oh, no, Ginger, you're wrong. It's not that. And bonus, I can name them. So now I have, granted, it's my own voice, but I have Roger and Bree theme and I have the Ridge theme or whatever. We don't know if it's called America theme or whatever. I'm calling it the Ridge theme for now because it's always when they're on the Ridge. So anyway, that's it.
Join us next week when we will be discussing episode 405. And I believe it is entitled Savages.
Thank you guys, as always, so much for listening. We would love to continue the conversation with you in our Facebook community and that you can find us at outlander.com/group. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.